Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Tracing Time, Seasons of Rock Art on the Colorado Plateau, by Craig Childs. Narrated by Craig Childs. For Diva, who led me there. Acknowledgements. I couldn't have thought up this book or claimed these stories by myself. I'm grateful to those who offered insights or showed the way through brush and canyons to some hidden image. Thank you, Polly Schaffsma, Jim Anote, Michael Loma Omvaya, Carol Patterson, Laurie Webster, Chris Lewis, Chuck LaRue, Kelly Hayes-Gilpin, Scott Thibany, Joe Paycheck, Rory Tyler, Gary and Ming Adams, and Kristen and Matt Redd. Much appreciation goes to my editor, Kirsten Johanna Allen, who recognized the importance of this book, and to the passionate, skilled crew at Torrey House Press. Susan Markley's assistants helped get this project off the ground, and her reads ushered it along. Tim Gontroff was always there for a quick read and feedback when ideas started tripping over themselves. To Gary Gackstetter, great thanks for the quill pen and ink illustrations, more than I could have ever asked for. Thank you to the Tozier brothers, Don, running cattle for the Ute, and Rex, farming green chilies on the Colorado side of the Four Corners. When I visited you in McKelmo Canyon, you told me you wanted more pages than the last book. Here you go. Time moves in one direction, memory another. We are the strange species that constructs artifacts intended to counter the natural flow of forgetting. William Gibson. Do you sense them, there, the ones who invented art, who saw that we might see? N. Scott Momaday. Introduction. Rock art is a practice in stillness. Finding it requires movement. For a spiral pecked into sandstone or a red phantom painted on a rock face 1,000 years ago, time is different than it is for you or me. To them, we must buzz like flies, never landing long enough to say anything of use. I am westbound on the California Zephyr, somewhere in Nevada, Polly Schaffsma's tome, Indian Rock Art of the Southwest, open in my lap. It's 1994 or 95, hard to keep track when you live by seasons. The desert flashes by, and I'm turning through pages of interconnected spirals and head-dressed artwork, historic photos, black-and-white sketches. Sometimes I look out the window at horizons shifting like swimmers at different paces, blue hulks of mountains turning slowly, rock outcrops streaking past. I wonder what I'm not seeing. If I were on foot, these distances would be crossed over weeks. I would stop and take in a warm breeze, searching for the smell of rain. My eye goes to the sky, blue as a polished stone, not a cloud in sight. These years, my time is spent between guiding, writing, and poring through the desert, journals loaded with sketches of bugs, plants, bones, and ancient imagery I'd find on rock. I am what you'd call a dirt bag. It's a variety of people consisting of poor climbers, alpinists, skiers, or other outdoor folks who live cheaply, without normal employment, and with few amenities, which allows them to focus as much time as possible on their sport. My sport is seeing. I walk long distances through undulating terrain, snow and rock ledges, waterless expanses, for no other purpose than to see. I tote Schaffsma along because what I've seen has made me want to know more. I've found ghost eyes peering out of holes as if through masks, elaborate regalia sprung from heads of anthropomorphs with arms, legs, eyes, and genitals. Rock art is all over the desert southwest, and I'd been rolling in it. Most of my life has been in the close company of these images. They are everywhere. Any place in the world you could say the same, you'll find bedrock riverbanks nibbled with petroglyphs, or an overhang of spiderwebs and hanging moss faintly painted with handprints and designs. The period from hunter-gatherers up to early agriculturalists is globally rich with imagery put to stone, no part of the habitable world left undecorated. It's a passage we go through as an early civilization, hands busy painting and etching, dances, ceremonies, hunts, and scenes of the day. Whether with dog sleds, masonry pueblos, Stonehenges, or pyramids, your people, too, went through this era. In the arid, bony Southwest, the work stands out as if electrified. Everywhere is a canvas, a boulder, a protected cliff. In my home metropolis of Tempe, Arizona, mountains and buttes are pecked around their crowns with chains of symbols. As a kid, I scrambled up summits, finding snake images, spirals, concentric circles, and rough anthropomorphs. In the eastern part of Arizona, where creeks flow through basalt, I explored petroglyphs of bear paws and butterflies, imagery tied to modern Hopi and Zuni people. The desert was not empty, wilderness not vacated. Though I seek solitude, I've never believed I was alone. The train hums and rocks on its rails, and something out the window catches my eye. It's fast enough my head whips up. I imagine we are traveling at 70 miles per hour, coming into what seems to have been gray, rough rock, though it might be brown. The details fly by too swiftly. What I saw was rock art, I'm certain of it. An entire panel blurred past. An older, quicker part of my brain must have caught it. What had it been? Rainbows and stick men, horned figures with dashes for eyes, a bear, a bird, a human track, a handprint. Before I can think, it's gone. I am so surprised by what I saw and how irretrievable it is. I look around at heads of scattered Amtrak travelers and almost, just almost, say something. I want to ask out loud if anybody saw what just flew past. It was only that I couldn't find the words that I kept quiet and remained seated. Who wants to involve the conductor? I immediately justify the sighting. Highways and train tracks are often set along rock art corridors. We've been traveling the same routes for a long time. There are highways where you remember to let off the accelerator, craning into the windshield to see petroglyphs of boxmen and bighorn sheep sailing by. Outside of Shiprock in New Mexico, try not to cause an accident looking up into mustard-colored alcoves above the highway. They hold pictographs that are looking down over the right-of-way fence and guardrail, not at you, but at the unimaginable blur of you. I close Shastma's book and peer out the window, looking for more. I don't know how many galleries and painted or pecked rock faces I've seen over the years. Thousands, I'd guess. I know people who fill files and ledgers with dates for the countless images they've seen, people whom I call rock art obsessives. I might be one, but I'm less organized. I note sights in a journal from time to time, snap some pictures, spend several minutes or an hour or a day or two, then move on. After a while, the journal hangs by your side, parted by your thumb, where you're supposed to be writing. Pen and paper feel useless when all you can do is stare. The Colorado Plateau has been a focal point for indigenous artists and storytellers since the end of the Ice Age. Most of the work comes from 1,000 or 2 years ago, the age of Basketmaker and Fremont, the earliest corn growers bridging the gap between agriculture and deeply animistic hunter-gatherer ways. I've heard that back then, these artists were more of a single people, not divided into names like Ute, Navajo, Paiute, and Pueblo, as if cut up on a butcher's table. This, I've been told by archaeologists, ethnographers, and indigenous people speaking of their own ancestry. I've heard that even earlier, in a mythical time, humans were more like fish or frogs, some with tails and webbed hands. The earth is said to have been soft, and tracks were left easily. This is how rock art came to exist, imagination making impressions on hardening boulders and cliffs. Whatever people did left a mark. Now I felt the world becoming soft again, as if reforming. The first year of the pandemic, I was acutely aware of how easily a great eraser could take out all that civilization has accomplished. I also saw how stories can last in detail for thousands of years, countless images pecked into soaring cliffs, not as bright as they'd been on day one, but still conveying their messages. For many years, I had little to say about rock art. I saw plenty of it and heard questions asked as if they were being pulled from a hat. Is that symbol a comet? Are these people fighting? Is that a corn plant? This is our most basic response to visual representation, questions, which are where the conversation begins. After long enough, though, I began to find threads and follow them. It has taken decades till I felt I had a place from which to speak. What I've written here is based on a little more than a year of intensive study during lockdowns and reopening. During those seasons, I spent more time with pecked and painted images than with living people. In southwest Colorado, I live in a nest of petroglyphs and pictographs extending hundreds of miles around me. Taking shelter from the sun or rain below an undercut boulder or rock overhang, I find painted people with upstretched arms, rows of spirit figures, zigzag designs climbing a wall onto the ceiling. There are spidering heads and insect people, scenes of hunting and warfare, armed figures holding up human scalps, and women squatting in childbirth. Histories are written here, footprints, handprints, bows and arrows, atlatls, spears, shields. Flute players are in rows, some on their backs, playing upward, some seated, some moving in processions, their penises raised like flags. I'm not offering a guidebook to places, but a guidebook to context, meaning, and ways of seeing. There are no maps or directions in this book. Exact locations are not deemed important. Particular sites you may already know, or you'll be 100 canyons off. Some are glaringly obvious right above the highway, and others take days on foot to reach, sometimes with the aid of rope. If you are hoping for photographs, I recommend the work of dedicated photographers like Bruce Hucko, Gary and Ming Adams, Jonathan T. Bailey, Dave Manley, and Eckhart Malotke. For my part, I bounced around the blob-shaped island of the Colorado Plateau across four states, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona, looking for patterns in the imagery, narrowing my study to a catalog of motifs. Instead of photographs, I use words, experiences, conversations, and the reflections of people following these ancient narratives. I define rock art as cultural imagery put to stone, not the gripes and scrawls of graffiti, which I call vandalism. What's the difference? Listen to the book. There are two basic kinds of rock art. Petroglyphs are made by pecking, scratching, or rubbing the rock. These are images put into the rock, breaking through the darker outside patina, which is a natural varnish of iron or manganese, exposing much brighter rock underneath. The contrast can stand out like neon. Pictographs, on the other hand, are made with pigments mixed with a binder such as blood, urine, or egg white. They are painted onto the rock, most often red, sometimes white, yellow, or blue. Why one technique or the other was used, hammer, stone, and bone chisel, or fingers and paintbrush, depends on the kind of rock, the tendency to weather, and if color was needed. Pictographs, being more friable, tend to be more protected. A pictograph will be a red birdman haunting the back wall of a rock shelter like a ghost. Petroglyphs you'll find on the blackened face of a boulder turned to the sky, pecked in tracks of deer, wolf, and mountain lion beside human-like bodies shaped like ladders. Some see mystery in these peckings and paintings, and others see identity. Jim Minot, a Zuni farmer born of the Corn Clan, a basket maker and soil scientist from northern New Mexico, sees relatives. When I spoke with Minot, his pueblo was closed off in the pandemic, while I was restricted to travel within my own county in Colorado. He told me on screen that when he encounters rock art, he greets it as if the images are living people. If it's morning, he says good morning. If it's midday, he says good afternoon. A note said, if there are writings, very likely somebody has lived nearby. And if somebody has lived nearby, there may also be somebody buried nearby. He asks the images, how was your day? And how did your night pass? He does not see them as only markings on rock. In the way that you would talk about life and death, those people are not completely gone, he said. If you were to remember their face and say their name, they are there. If you see their mark, they are there. I see them. I greet them. I acknowledge them. They've dissolved. Their bones and flesh have dissolved. Their oils, their fats have dissolved into the soil. They are part of the soil. The soil has brought nutrients, has helped these grasses and these trees to grow. They are here. Rock art is not an artifact. It is an action still happening. When I see petroglyphs and pictographs, basic questions come to mind. What do these figures and symbols convey to me now? What did they say to the people in their time? How do they fit with other sites and repeated motifs, stories being told across distances? The entire Colorado Plateau, around 250,000 square miles of mostly exposed rock, is an open book. The questions move on from what am I reading to where am I on the land? How did I get here? And how did they get here? What are the flute players playing? A resplendent person depicted holding a snake by one outstretched arm means what? I am drawn to Polly Schaffsma's research because of how she applies archaeological rigor to rock art, a subject mostly left out of academic disciplines. Potsherds and architecture can be sampled and dated, their purpose intrinsically functional, but rock art is liminal. Its function was to communicate, commemorate, or just to give hands something to do. It could have been made for countless elusive reasons, original meanings as fleeting as the artists who made them. But it is definable, Schaffsma found. She linked styles and motifs across an arid, geographically complex part of the continent, finding that starbursts, bighorn sheep, plumed serpents, spirals, and the rest of the pantheon were not floating randomly like alphabet soup, but were part of a bigger narrative. The Book of the Colorado Plateau can be read. Decades after I first picked up her work, I spoke with Polly Schaffsma, an octogenarian PhD with a lifelong career spent studying pictographs and petroglyphs in the Southwest. With a wonderful imagination firmly grounded in science, I think of her as the Ursula K. Le Guin of ancient imagery. When she talks, tiny figures seem to fly out of her, birds and animals, designs she's seen in the field. You put things on rocks that aren't just everyday things, she said. You might represent some kind of spiritual being, compelling it to be there. In other words, these images are perceived as powerful, and they can command spirits. The images she describes are not objects on shelves ready to decipher, but are portrayals of lives and visions. They are a window into ancient dreaming. Schaffsma told me, when rock art is made, it sits there and is open to interactions for centuries and centuries and centuries. It is not static. That's what's so exciting about it. It's alive in the sense that people come and put meaning onto it continuously. Is it art? I've been urged to find a more accurate or sensitive term. The use of rock art rubs some people wrong, relegating it to leisure and impressionism when these ancient images can look like a pictographically written language or symbols imbued with prayers. Some of it is counting, some remembering, some pointing to combat or hunts, some to fertility. You could call it a ledger, a palimpsest, or a dry erase board that takes millennia to clear itself. It is a gallery, a church, a portal into an earlier time when the earth was soft. Kelly Hayes Gilpin, archaeology faculty at Northern Arizona University and a researcher at the Museum of Northern Arizona in Flagstaff, told me, "We don't know what it means, but we know it was meaningful. That's kind of all we need to know as archaeologists." Hayes Gilpin learned scientific field techniques as a kid, growing up with a father who was a research chemist and an avocational archaeologist. She specializes in ancestral iconography, and she freely uses the word art. She said, "A commercialized individual Western concept is not what art means. Are you saying indigenous people don't have art? That's inflammatory. Art is something meant to invoke an aesthetic response. It's an interchange between the creator and the viewer or audience. It's deeper than just communicating simple information. One of the more flexible words in the English language, art, is defined as human creative skill, doing something as a result of knowledge and practice. It is the mind's eye rendered in visual form. Everybody has art, Hayes Gilpin said. This is what it means to be human. It's your response to nature. It's your response to another person. It's your response to an image. Then your reinterpretation of that experience for others. If that's not art, what is the word for it? Along the San Juan River, not far from the intersection of Arizona, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico, in the Four Corners, I've been going over the same walls for decades. Crowded with petroglyphs, the walls chatter and shout, and sometimes I've stared and stared and nothing comes out. In the summer, blood-colored sandstone turns silver with hot light. Petroglyphs burn like film exposed in the sun. During the fall, the angle softens and cliffs turn gold, footlit by changing cottonwood leaves. Every kind of light alters what you see. I've come in moonlight on a summer night, hands in pockets, seeing each tiny blow from the artist's stroke, blue shadows gathered to form antenna-headed figures, or people standing like acrobats on the backs of bighorn sheep. Thousands of figures appear on canvases of rock over several miles along canyon walls. You'll see spear throwers, ant-like people, and a bighorn sheep standing on its hind legs playing a flute. About 10 miles north of here is a cave painted with handprints. East by 20 miles, boulders are big enough to crush houses, strewn below a high-capped mesa, their faces meticulously articulated into petroglyphs. 30 miles south are walls upon walls of triangle men. Between them is more. Beyond them is more. They are everywhere. By 5 o'clock on a December evening, near the winter solstice, light picks up speed toward sunset. Along the river, cliffs fall into shadow, while others grow coppery and bright. As one figure appears in the last quickening glimpses of the day, another goes out. This is my favorite time of day for viewing. 2 huge feet, shoe-size 50, lose their sun. 5 toes invisibly rendered bunions slipping into shadow. Nearby, a human-like form the size of my torso holds the last light before slipping over to shade, as if gathering the last sun into itself. This figure would be called an anthropomorph, trapezoidal body, stick for a neck, and a circle for a head, with hair bobs or ear ornaments pictured to either side. Anthro, because it looks human, and morph, because it appears more than human. The figure's left hand is held up as if waving to the audience, which, for now, is us. Shadows cup into every strike mark, making up its body, causing the figure to pop. A dark, sharp line, terminus of the sunset, descends across it, beginning at the right elbow, moving to the shoulder, the head. The left hand is lifted as if to touch the last light, and you can see every pecked joint. The petroglyph of a tiny person stands on the anthropomorph's shoulder next to its ear. What is it whispering? You hear the river behind you rippling over cobbles. Ice cracks and shifts. The petroglyphs are silent, but you can hear them, and they sound like a long, deep breath. They sound like the pause before something said. I am writing this book for you. Whomever you are standing with me at the foot of this cliff, watching light fill this mysterious figure and the companion on its shoulder. You've got drinking water in a pack, and a warm coat, gloves, and a hat for nightfall. It will get cold. A headlamp is in a pocket for when you leave. When the light changes swiftly at the end of the day, take a moment to watch. Let your eye go to where it wishes. In this last sunlight, become as human as possible, the one you were before paved highways and the skies plastered with contrails. Feel the shape of boulders with red grit blown between them. Cold river air drifts through willow copses, sweet with the smell of fallen and rotting leaves. Follow the warmth, the last light as it climbs the rock and pinches out overhead, turning all the petroglyphs gray. Stay until the last glow depletes and the night opens wide. The bow of the Milky Way stretches over the river, the sky frozen and moonlessly bright. Slushbergs hiss as they slide past each other on their way to the dark vaults of Lake Powell. Your eyes strain to make out the boldest representations on the cliff, but it's more what you feel than what you see. The images have presence. They were never merely markings on rock. They have life, wisdom, memory. This is them telling their story. Chapter 1. Handprints. Perched on the imaginary crosshairs of the Four Corners, the high desert is salted with caves. They are not deep, cramped, and lightless, but yawning holes like moons risen inside the rock. They come in shapes like skulls and empty eye sockets. If you walk inside, human skeletons may be under your feet, chest cavities feeling your weight. Be careful where you step. The mummy of a baby in its cradle board was found in one cave, a handful of necklaces with turquoise beads and polished bone discs in another. A soaring alcove shaped like the inside of a clamshell revealed a rattle made from a beaver tail sewed closed and sinewed onto a stick. The small leathery purse came out of peach-colored dust mixed with corn cobs and little black pills of wood rat droppings. It is now in a museum drawer, climate-controlled, its fired clay balls rattling inside when you put on cotton gloves and softly turn it from side to side. To reach the cave where the beaver tail rattle was dug up, take a lone highway that crosses Utah and Arizona and turn off to the west at an unmarked ranch gate. Close the gate behind you with a twist of wire and follow a two-track across sage and sand. In some places, the sand will be deep enough you won't want to let off the accelerator, and then the road will be made of rock, and a few miles per hour is not too slow. Park where the road ends and walk down into a canyon, passing grinding holes in bedrock, and open-mouth caves, one that held a baby mummy, and another that once bore beads and discs. Looking back at these two caves, the rock they are in seems amphibious, a sandstone head of a frog the size of Godzilla. There will be rock art along the way, petroglyphs of corn plants and snakes. A piece of cliff fell recently, its boulders thrown across the floor like meteorites, flattening sagebrush and Mormon tea. This will help give you a sense of time, how fast or slow this landscape moves and falls apart, the range of catastrophe always waiting. If you shout along the canyon, in some places your echo will come back, startlingly clear. All you have to do is talk at a conversational tone, and you'll hear yourself from a few hundred feet away. This, I'm told, is one way to find rock art. Walk around clapping, and when you hear a good echo, go look. Past the clearest echo, turn into a side canyon, and you'll notice the gaping oval of a cave. It is the shape of a hollow shell, a bivalve the size of a lecture hall. I went with a small group into this cave on an early spring afternoon, finding the ground inside jackhammered with old looters' holes. Brittle and hard corn cobs from centuries ago lay in the dust, requiring careful steps, coming over the notation of cricket tracks and rodent dimples. This is where the rattle was found. Weather doesn't reach far inside, and the ground is as dry as powdered bone. Drop anything in here, and it could remain for centuries. A pen would survive ice ages. Jonathan Till, archaeologist and curator at the edge of the Cedars State Park Museum in Blanding, Utah, oversees the collection holding this rattle. He was with us in the cave and told me, "The sound of the rattle evokes the pattering sound of rain, of course. One can't help but observe that beaver is a water animal. Potentially powerful water associations with that artifact." As if in an empty band shell, our voices bounced around us, the laughter and conversation of explorers with day packs and water bottles. We were one of the last outfits to launch before lockdown, mid-March 2020. Our trip billed as an archaeological field course, sleeping on the ground, waking with sunrise. Forehead temperatures were checked and we'd been thrown in a van, sent into the backcountry for a week, told if we didn't pull out of the parking lot immediately, the trip would be canceled. The virus was spreading quickly. An archaeologist from the Greasewood clan at Hopi was supposed to be working alongside me.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?